Number 8941, rule number 4.
Major Jefferson, rule 4. I think you're explaining that you didn't stop in Cairo, but at a camp outside.
We stayed at Cowley Camp. I'm not even certain whether I got into Cairo that night. I know that Lawrence Boyd, Captain Boyd, who commanded E Troop, actually went shopping in Cairo with a 25-pounder behind him, because I've got his story of what happened. I think I was probably all the officer, having been advance party all the way. And we moved on next morning. I don't remember anything of Cairo at that time at all.
So you went straight on to Mersa Matruh?
Yeah, well, we went straight on down the road, turn left, and I think if we spent the next night at Daba, near the aerodrome. And at El Daba, that night, and this is easily checked because it's mentioned in many histories, there was an air raid on El Daba Airport, aerodrome. And it was just a little way. We weren't quite on the aerodrome, we were perhaps 4 or 5 miles off. But bombs fell, what, to people coming from the desert, from the Iraqi desert, was fairly close. And I remember that night, we had by now these metal quads, not the old wooden quads that we brought from India. We had these metal quads with the sloping front, almost like an aircraft pilot's lookout, with windows at about just a bit more than 45 degrees. And I remember that night we went round smashing all the windows on the quads with pick handles, because it was thought that the moon was reflecting on them and guiding the German bombers. We moved on next morning, and we got to Sidi Hanesh at about 4:30 the next afternoon, I think.
Was this moving across desert or along road?
Oh, that's along the metal track, along the railway line.
Was it the coast road or
the coast road? Yes, okay. Yes.
And was that coast road fairly free, or was there traffic on it?
No. There was us moving up, and a large number of other people moving the other way.
What sort of condition were they in?
They certainly would not merit any derogatory, any adjective that would suggest that they were in rout. They were in dribs and drabs, because they were bits that had been broken up. They were largely, when I come to think of it, I know who they were. They were quite largely, from Mersa Matruh anyway, units that had been sent back. Because at around the 26th of June, they were collecting up a company per battalion back in the base in case things got bad.
As a reserve force.
Yeah, as a reserve force. And indeed, the 1st 4th Essex, who are in my story, they sent back Major Leonard Chappell. And he eventually appears in my story because he was sent back. So that quite a lot of the people that were sent back were being sent back under orders anyway, as small units rather than big units. But then, of course, you get large things like lumps of Bailey Bridge and that sort of thing on a small road like that. I can't say it was I was certainly it was a disorganised looking group that came was flying past us, but they certainly weren't dispirited in the sense of all in tears or all screaming at high heaven. were just moving that other way and we were moving this way. Until, of course, when we got close to Mercimeter, when the road became rather silent.
What was Sidi Hanesh like? What, as a place? What was there there?
All I remember is a spur running down to the sea, which was behind us. And then, I suppose, the spur ran a bit like my telephone. And indeed, there could be the sea. There was this spur, that this was the road along this line here. There was a spur running down to the sea here, where we went in, where the Germans eventually came. And then there is the escarpment, and there's the sea. And I suppose the distance from the escarpment to the sea, where we eventually fetched up, would be 1,500, 1,600 yards, of which half would be on the land side and half on the seaside of the actual road itself.
What happened to you when you got to Sidi Hanesh? Did you take up firing positions immediately?
No, because we were merely marching towards the scene of battle. I mean, it wasn't meant to be at Mercimeter at all. We stopped and brewed up. One always brewed up. I can be fairly certain of saying that we brewed up.
You just stopped by the road, did you?
Well, I'm pretty certain that we dispersed. We would disperse in a reasonable sort of routine. I know that I was at that particular time on the seaward side of the road where most of B echelon was. Why I was there, I don't know, but I just remember being on the right of the road, that's all. But we've certainly dispersed, and the CO went off to get orders from Crusher Nichols of 50 Div.
What was your own appointment at that time?
At that time I was command post officer of the 8385 battery.
And what were your principal functions as command post officer?
Well, of course, I'd just finished being advance party. I'd really just got back to the regiment, to my own position in the column. As command post officer, then, as I hope now, one's first job is to survey in the command, the regiment, the guns. The second one is to is information and intelligence in general, but more important, of course, the purpose of doing the survey is to ensure that the guns fire right. And the specific duty was linking the guns when they had to fire as a battery rather than just as individual guns or a troop. And that was one part of the survey that was particularly important.
How many people were there in the battery command post? What was its size?
I can't give you a complete answer to that because, of course, the number of people in the command post, which was the command post with a hole in the ground, or in the sand, or stones, or a truck, yeah, and there may on occasions have been quite a large number of people in that hole, but the command post consisted of the command post officer, the assistant command post officer, and his job, which I'd had earlier in France, of course. His job was to run the command post while the command post officer was out doing the surveys. Yeah. Because we used to survey into within a metre in those days, as they still do, in stages 1, 2, 3, and maybe more. So there's the command post officer, the assistant command post officer, there'd be, I think there were 4 surveyors, there may have been 5 surveyors.
These were other ranks, were they?
Other ranks, trained other ranks.
So they'd be NCOs, presumably, fairly high grade.
I think the lowest was a Lance Bombardier, and certainly there was a sergeant amongst them, but they were all technicians, they were all highly skilled men. They were doing survey, just like the chaps you see out doing survey today on the road. So there was the four or five technicians. The command post office was, of course, the under the battery captain, the battery headquarters. The battery captain ran the battery headquarters, but the command post officer was the chap who did all the work there. The battery captain was senior rank in those days to me. So that the signal sergeant, whether he actually came under me or whether he just reported to me, I don't know. But I mean, the signal exchange was always near the battery command post, and the signal sergeant ran it in, and his truck came behind my truck. His was M1, if I remember right, in the line of march. So the signallers were, if not part of the command post, certainly very closely associated with it, the battery exchange.
How many lines, presumably, were you operating on line or on radio at this stage?
Ideally, we had a line out throughout the war. I went into one battle in Italy with seven lines out, seven different ways of communicating. One always liked to have line if one could. And in the desert, there weren't so many roads for things to get cut on. So line was our preferred method of communication, particularly as in those days our tock sets were, well, they were basically W tock sets, and I think it was a 101 set, which was a very more in hope than anger operation anyway. And indeed, I nearly killed myself once because a little later than we're talking about, it was in the desert. It was one of my first forays into an OP. In fact, it was my very first day as observation officer running my own troop. And I went out and registered a target and got to gunfire, and we had to use the artillery code to do it. Yeah? And the artillery code, you use individual letters, that sort of thing, to indicate range. And instead of sending down something like 9400, we sent down 4900. And I was at 4875. So we weren't all that fond of our wireless sets at the time, in June 42. Later on, they became much better. But
so when you were speaking online, did you transmit instructions in clear?
Depending on what the instructions were. I mean,
but if you were giving orders for gunfire, did you give it in clear or did you give it in a code?
It again depends what the orders were. I mean, in those days we were trained to be moving down the road like I've just described in the Mercer True. If at that moment I had shouted down the phone, "Don troop action," down the telephone lines, 2,000 fire, they would have been around on the ground in time 1 minute. I mean, that was what we were trained to do. And for that, you don't need code. I think that nearly all my actual gunnery control was done in plain, because I mean, the answer is going to come down on the ground anyway. But we did use code when we had to, and I say the example I'm thinking of, well, because we were on W top instead of R top, we had to use a code, because the artillery code was designed originally for semaphore, for flashing from hilltops in the Khyber Pass.
At that time, when you were at Sidi Hanesh, how many lines could the command post exchange handle?
We didn't set up the command post in Sidi Hanesh. I was just in my truck, and there was another truck 150 yards away, another truck 150 yards away, and the regiment was spread out on two sides of the road, and the colonel went up to the GOC and said, Lentfield Regiment arrives. In fact, there was a milestone, a kilometre stone, just outside Matru. One account has it as kilometre 15, one has it as kilometre 25. The probability is it was kilometre 15, but that the anti-tank regiment, a battery, was 10 kilometres behind. Yeah, but certainly there was a kilometre stone there, and I think it was 15, which said 11th regiment stop. Yeah. And that's where we stopped. We deployed. Yes, Dal? Okay, well. Had I answered your question? Or
No, I was going to ask you, at this time, this stage of the war, how many. Presumably you'd have a rear link from battery command post to RHQ, and you'd have a forward link from command post to.
Two troops.
So you'd have two links forward to the troops, one back to RHQ. Did you have lateral lines across to other battery command posts as well?
Can't remember. I would think it would be through RHQ, but I can't remember, to be honest. But in any case, if we're going to stop in Sidi Hanesh for breakfast lunch, there we weren't in action. We were simply spread out, not deployed in a battle sense, but deployed in an en route sense, looking at the sea and the escarpment, and suddenly something goes bang over there behind you, and you know the war started.
Now, you say your commanding officer had been off to get orders from the 50th Division. What orders did he bring back?
That our B echelon was to be brigaded under 50 Div and stay in Sidi Hanesh, commanded by Captain John Evans Lawrence of the other battery, with Jimmy Breckle of our battery in charge of our B echelon, and that we were to break out that night. Starting, I think we formed up about 7 and marched about 9. But I wouldn't be too a little while on that.
What were you to do in the interim before forming up to break out?
Well, I went and got my bottle of whiskey from the officer's mess truck, which the Lord be praised. I don't think we weren't in any particular alarm or despondency or anything. We were just a bit sad that we were leaving our sleeping bags and things in the mess truck and going off on a fairly light scale of equipment. But we knew the road had been cut behind us. At least, we strongly suspected the road had been cut behind us. I think it wasn't actually proved until later that night. But there were noises coming from that direction that couldn't be explained any other way. We imagined, because don't forget, we hadn't actually been in action in the Western Desert so far. We'd had a little action elsewhere. We imagined that the desert to the south of us, over the escarpment, was swarming with panzers and people ill-inclined towards us. I don't think we had any real idea of how the desert absorbs an army in either sense, either in the sense that an armoured division occupies an enormous area of the desert, we found that out next night, or the sense that you can have a lot of people there and not notice that they're there. So we started out.
Was this after dark?
This was. I think we formed up at about 7 as dark was forming, and I think it was about 9 o'clock when we moved. I think by then The desert was fairly dark. Certainly, by the time we got across the escarpment, it was pitch black. There was a bit of a moon. So when I say pitch black, I don't mean it was, you couldn't see your hand in front of your face. I mean it was fully night.
How far could you see if you were looking ahead?
At the time I'm thinking of, not very far. And indeed, that's why E Troop got lost. Because as you come out of the area above Sid Hanais, you go over an escarpment, and then you go through some fairly steep and sharp and sandy nullahs and creeks and things. And certainly one gun of E Troop got stuck, and the others had difficulty getting round it. As command post officer, I wasn't concerned with anything except taking my own truck through, and so I wasn't really sort of part of any organised effort at all. I was just tagging along with the rest, and I don't really know what was going on, because I had no reason to know what was going on. But I do know that in the course of that night, we lost E Troop, less perhaps one gun, which I think came with us, and we lost a troop of 265 anti-tank, which, as I've explained already, was then part of 11th Field at that particular short time. They had two pounders, and we lost a troop of them. But by about midnight, 1 o'clock-ish, we were well on the top of the escarpment and going over more level ground, which by then, of course, was fairly brightly lit, not only by a moon, but by chaps pooping things off in all directions and chaps overhead dropping flares. And I remember so clearly the way that Tracer, or particularly Tracer from a gun like a Bofors, comes at you so slowly. And then, of course, it sings like a bee as it goes by. But it is amazing that it starts off so slowly. And so I just stoozed along. But in the course of that little fracas, the second-in-command, Pat Waterfield, and Major Paul of the anti-tank battery, and I think my own VC Dougie, at some stage they turned up with 9 prisoners. There was a bit of a shooting on the port bow. 9 young Germans were added to the column. I don't think that I saw them that night, but later on, as I can tell you, I actually had them in the back of my truck and was responsible for them. They were worried to me.
You said you formed up. What sort of formation did you use for this breaking out?
Well, our normal formation, of course, was to have it's almost like a navy with frigates and minesweepers and battleships in the middle. But I don't think that night we could possibly have done it quite as on such a broad scale as that, because we were really following little tracks through minefields, so we must have been more or less in line ahead. But I don't remember. I'm not all that much memory of that particular night at all, other than the fact that this was going on.
Apart from seeing shot being fired at you, did you actually see anything else of the enemy? Did you see enemy vehicles?
No, most of the war I didn't. I mean, this is what we were talking about at lunch. It's things that's going on around you. And this was just following my leader and having problems of can I get my truck through here and get that ruddy sand mat out, and where's my pickaxe? Those are the things that worry you much more than what's going on in a military sense, at least if you're a fairly junior officer and not actually concerned with the operation itself. I, as command post officer, I had no duties other than to be there.
To just getting your own truck through in the column.
And of course, looking at the chap on either side of you was still there, but no specific duties of any sort.
Did your regiment go out on its own, or did it go out as part of a larger outfit?
We had some infantry with us. I think it was, I could check this if it's of any particular interest, but I think it was the 9th DLI or the East Yorks. It was one of the 50 div a company or two companies of one of the 50 div battalions. I'm sure they were at some stage East Yorks, at one stage some Green Howards and perhaps some 9 DLI. But who, exactly who was with us that night, I have no idea, because I didn't see them anyway. I just saw shadows on my left and my right and sparks of light and things that went bang.
Have you no idea why it was decided that you should break out rather than remaining in the perimeter at Mersa Matruh?
Not in the sense you're probably asking the question, no. I mean, I wasn't thinking of strategy or tactics, but it didn't take a great deal of imagination to realise that was the best thing to do, because we weren't going to defend Matruh anyway. And I think I don't know if we were told that, but I think we realised that Matruh was not the defensible place. I don't think that anyone had ever mentioned the word Alamein at that stage, to me anyway. No, that's not quite true. I think we knew that there was a position 40 miles wide between the sea and the Katara Depression. We may just have called it Alamein, but I don't think it was a word that had any particular significance as such. I don't think that it was part of any plan or order that, of which I was aware. Indeed, I doubt if I had a map. And I later doubt whether my CO had a map, in fact, because we rushed through and he misspells one or two words in a way that in his diary that suggested to me that he never actually saw a map.
So your orders were just to follow the track in front and keep... keep going.
They boiled down to that. There probably was an order saying 50 Div will withdraw to the left in fours or something, but in the end, the colonel came back. We were all experienced in the desert. We all knew that the consequence of that order would be follow that truck and don't lose sight of him, for God's sake.
How long did it take for the colonel to give you your orders and brief you?
He didn't give me any orders.
He didn't.
I suppose the battery commander must have done. Well, I wasn't aware of them. I mean, they were... we mentioned the word instinct earlier. I think you have to, and I think you yourself have suggested it, that if you're a trained soldier, and we were fairly well trained by now, that a nod's as good as a wink. And someone says, well, we've got to march 12 miles in that direction. You know exactly what's required of you by day and by night.
Were the orders then given verbally, or was there any written?
I doubt if there were ever any written orders below Crasher Nichols. I doubt it. I said.